Bone-chilling greetings, everybody. The tunes are courtesy of Bobby Mackey, and I, of course, am your host, Tessa Morrow. Thanks for stopping by and making Paranormal Prowlers podcast part of your morning, day, night, graveyard shift. Whenever you listen and wherever you are listening from the Colorado Rockies to the Canadian Rockies, from the suburbs to the boonies, from tropical paradise to tiny village, and you guessed it, everything in between. It is greatly appreciated.
Round of applause. This week's city shout-out goes to
Covington, Georgia, Callaway, Minnesota, South Amboy, New Jersey, Trujillo, Peru, Oswestry, England, and Douglas, Isle of Man. Definitely need your passport for that one, my friends. Four different countries. Woohoo! Now today I continue the Vampire Killer series, and I want to warn you ahead of time that some of the content, a lot of the content actually, includes sexual assault and the murders of several children. Now first up is a Belgian serial killer named Stoff van Eycken. He was a monster better known as the Vampire of Muizen. Now, between late 1971 and into early mid-1972, he wreaked havoc in the area and would murder at least three women. He not only enjoyed terrorizing his victims, raping them, and savagely attacking them like some mad animal, but he also took pleasure in biting them to the point where they would bleed. Home life was anything but homey and comfy for Stoff. He was born into poverty. His family, they were dirt poor. His father was a horrific alcoholic and would go on to abandon his wife and children. His mother finds another love interest. They marry and they have a daughter together. But this new hubby of hers is also a raging alcoholic. And Stoff would later on share that he was being abused by his new stepdad. She sure knows how to pick them. Not only that, but Stoff would also go on to say that his aunt was sexually assaulting him, and that this wasn't just a one-time thing, that it had been going on for several years. His mother is not well, health-wise, and is crippled with MS, which left her confined to a wheelchair. Because of her state, mom obviously could not take care of a newborn child, and there's no way an alcoholic father, who is also proven to be abusive, can take care of the child by himself. So she is sent to live with the next door neighbors, an elderly couple. Now you'd think that would be convenient, right? I mean, they're right next door to each other. When birth mom wants to go see the baby, she's able to. I mean, that would have worked out. It would have been a good system right there. But sadly, tragedy strikes when the elderly couple, along with Stoff's baby sister, die due from inhaling toxic fumes from the stove. Utterly heartbreaking. And tragedy would strike again when Stoff's father, the abandoner, commits suicide due to guilt that he held on to for a murder that he was responsible for while he served with the Foreign Legion. Now, bad things happened to him as a child, and that sucks, big time. I mean, he was abused by someone he should have been able to trust, his stepfather. He was raped by his aunt for several years. I mean, that's horrific, and nobody deserves that, especially a small, defenseless child. But he would turn around and later bring complete and utter terror to people himself. And like his heinous aunt, he too would become a stranger danger, a rapist, a pedophile. Now, at the tender age of 14, he rapes an 11-year-old little girl, and he graduates to murder on Wednesday, October the 13th of 1971. He would claim his very first victim, or his known first victim, And it was due to this murder that he would gain the moniker the Vampire of Musin. An 18-year-old woman named Marie-Thérèse Rossel was raped and strangled, and during the attack would also suffer from several bites, including on her breasts. His next victim was a 47-year-old woman named Ida Smeets. Now Stoff, he abducts her. He takes her to this old abandoned factory where he attempts to rape her, but is unsuccessful. He's angry and he's frustrated that he could not commit this act, rape. He strangles her. He leaves her there. He goes home, does God knows what, and comes back a short while later with the intentions of committing necrophilia. But to his utter shock, his victim, Ida, who is a lot stronger will-wise than he thought, she is still alive. What this poor woman went through, death was not sudden for her. I mean, he strangles her once more, and she sadly succumbs to her injuries this time. Ida would happen to die the very same day that Stoff's mother died, her cause of death unknown. Now, that's like a mystery too, right? Like, did he kill his mother? Or did he find his mother dead and he was just so mad that he had to kill somebody? Don't know. Either one, that's not good. And when it comes back to Ida, my heart just breaks for her. I mean, my heart breaks for every victim, obviously, but he kidnaps her, tries to sexually assault her. When that doesn't work, he strangles her. He goes home, I don't know for how long. I bet every single minute felt like an eternity, though. And this poor woman is still alive, scared, terrified, and hurt. Just had been strangled, right? This guy, this monster, comes back. She's obviously in bad enough shape that while he's gone, she can't run for help. So she's just there waiting for him to come back to kill her. Oh my gosh, just absolutely excruciatingly painful. Now, the rest of 1971 goes on without any further known deaths. And then in mid-March the following year, in 1972, he would claim his final victim, a 19-year-old girl named Lutgarde Vanderwilt, an acquaintance that he had danced with in a youth club in the past. He rapes her, strangles her, and her breasts bear bite marks. Now the murderer, he sticks around the area, and when the authorities come, they notice that this man is acting very strange. And more telling, he actually had blood on his clothing. I mean, he couldn't have looked more guilty unless he had tattooed on his forehead, "I did it, I'm the killer." So he's arrested on sight, thank God. He confesses to not only the murder of Lutgarde, but also the first two murders of Marie-Thérèse and Ida. He never denied anything, and he also was very hell-bent on being locked up. He told authorities that, look, I will continue to strangle, I will continue to rape, and I will continue to kill if I remain on the streets a free man. So he demanded, lock me up, throw away the key. Yeah, sure, dude, no problem. You do not have to ask twice. So Stoff van Eyken was sentenced to death, which almost immediately was turned around and changed to a life sentence. And he remains there to this very day, and he is serving his sentence in Leuven Central. He has been there for 45 years, making him the longest serving living detainee in Belgium. Next up is Brazilian serial killer Marcelo Costa de Andrade, better known as the Vampire of Niterói. A deeply disturbed individual, he would go on to rape and murder at least 14 young boys. Now, like the vampire serial killer before him, Stoff, Marcelo's life at home as a child was anything but normal and peaceful. His mother, she was often beat by his abusive father. And while I couldn't find anything about the father abusing Marcelo, he did not escape abuse, as when his mother and father finally go their own ways, as a child, he is abused by his parents' new love interests. He also would fall victim to rape from an elderly man. So both killers today in this episode were not only abused, but also sexually abused as children. Now, to escape the abuse at home, the young Marcello, he was sent to live with his grandparents. But guess what? He wasn't safe there, too. They, too, would beat the child, oftentimes with belts or really just anything they could get their grubby hands on. He was dysfunctional. He was unhinged. And maybe he thought it was okay because it had been done to him, the act of rape. But in his head, he thinks it's okay to rape his younger brother. Now, while he attempts this disgustingly heinous act, he thankfully is very unsuccessful. And I hope he got his ass beat by his kid brother for that horrible attempt. But, you know, something, obviously he is not right in the head if he thinks it's okay to do that. Now, Marcello, he does really lousy in school, which makes sense. When you have things like that going on at home, you're being beat, you're being raped, it's hard to concentrate on schoolwork. When I was being bullied, I proved to be a horribly lousy student as well. It sucks. But guess what? You go on. You keep trucking. I didn't become a rapist, nor did I become a serial killer. Now, he continues as a young man to go down a dreaded path of destruction. Marcello, he turns to prostitution. But after a scary encounter with a much older man, it scares him enough where he grows depressed and he actually tries to take his own life. Now, I may sound like a monster saying this, but if he were successful with that suicide attempt, at least 14 boys would still be alive today. At least 14. The thing is, with serial killers, sometimes you don't know the true number of victims. Now, for a while, it seems like he did a 180. He abandoned the act of selling his body for money, one of the oldest professions around, and he begins working an honest job. He spends the money on his family. He helped pay bills, which helped a great deal because his family, remember, they were in poverty. And he was actually becoming a respectful human being. I mean, who would have thought this was possible? So he even starts to go to church, oftentimes in person. And while at home, he would watch TV about church and God and what have you. I mean, things seem okay, right? Things seem good. Well, stay tuned, guys. It's about to get messy, very messy, and very disturbing. During this time when he was attending church and watching religious sermons on TV, he heard something that stayed with him. That when children die, they immediately go to heaven. Now, I am unsure if he had killed prior to this, but in his eye, he was going to help send children to heaven. In his eyes, supposedly, he was a savior because he would not kill adults who may go to hell, but only children, who would get like a one-time ticket to heaven. Children plus death equals heaven. In his demented mind, this is what he thought or claimed to think. Now that's why it's crucial that things be said fragile around certain people, like the serial killer, because things can be exaggerated or out of context, or hey, that's going to be a good excuse to use. And then you have this moron thinking that he can actually do something like commit these horrific acts and have it considered a good deed. But really, I think this was just honestly an excuse because the murders would prove to be very sexual in nature, extremely sexual. And why kill a child so they can go to heaven? But then why rape the child in the process? None of this makes sense to me in the slightest. First of all, didn't you ever learn that killing is bad, just in general, whether it's a child or an adult? Hey, guess what? That child should go live into adulthood. Enjoy life, not being brutally raped and murdered as a young child. Horrible, horrible, horrible human being. No, scratch that. He's a monster. A ghoulish monster. He's the definition of what mom and dad tell their kids to stay away from. Now, Marcello's method of killing, it was up close and personal. It was strangulation. He commits his first known murder in April of 1991. His final murder would be in December of that very year. And that would be his undoing, that final killing. Now, one April day, he is out and about when he sees something that stops him in his tracks. A young boy on the street trying to sell candy to locals. An innocent act. Like, literally, the only thing this child did that was wrong, unbeknownst to him, was being in the wrong place at the wrong time. He approaches the young child and promises him money if he helps do some religious stuff with him. The boy, he agrees. He thinks, okay, easy money. Why would he think this person would do anything but what he said he was going to do? So Andrade, he takes the child to a secluded area, tries to rape him, and a fight takes place. The boy is in a fight for his life. There's no way in hell this is going to happen, this sexual assault, and the child is killed in the process. After he is dead, the body is sexually assaulted, and a budding serial killer is born. Now, not long after he claims the life of another boy, this time he drinks the blood of the child. With one of the victims, he would take the child's life, then come back before the body could be found by authorities, and he decapitates the dead child's head. Again, I mean, just what a monster. Seriously. The final murder takes place in mid-December. Two brothers, they are on their way to have lunch with a neighbor, Alter and Ivan. And as they travel, they were encountered by a strange man. He promised them money if they would join him and help him perform some religious ritual act. This was obviously a ruse. He had other plans for these two young innocent boys. Something evil, something only a heinous pedophile would approve of. And like all of his young victims, the two brothers, the little boys, they didn't know or think such evil existed on Earth. They trust the man and they go with him. So the three get on a bus, and Stranger Danger has them get off at some desolate beach. The boys, they look around, and there's not a soul around, and at this point, I could only imagine that they're most likely confused, and they had to have felt that something was not right with this situation. And it doesn't take long for things to go horribly wrong. Just a matter of seconds, really. The killer goes to Ivan, and he tries to kiss the child. Scared, he makes a run for it. Like, this isn't natural. Why is this strange man trying to kiss me? So the child runs in the fight for his life, trying to get away. The predator chases his prey, tackles him, rapes him right there on the spot. He then strangles the child. And he proceeds to tell Alter that his brother Ivan is okay, that he's just simply asleep. Well, the child knew that this was a downright lie. He saw with his very eyes everything. The attempt of a kiss, the chase, the attack, the rape, the murder. So many bad things happen in just such a short amount of time. This kid was no fool. He was no idiot. Alter, he could have screamed, begged for mercy, cried, tried to escape. No judgment there. That's what I probably would have done if in that horrific and terrifying situation. But Alter, he was a young child. He kept a cool head. His actions were as cool as a cucumber. Inside his head, I'm sure he was terrified. But he knew that if he was to survive this, if he was to go to live another day and see his family again, that he had to be strong. He had to treat this obviously demented man as a friend. Not as a monster. So the child, he did not try to escape or make a run for it, nor did he try to scream or cry or beg for mercy. No, he stayed with the killer. When Andrade asked him to do something, by golly, the child did it. If he said jump, the child was like, how high? He was just trying to please this man, this monster. So Marcelo, the rapist, the child killer, and Alter, the innocent child who just saw his brother be brutally raped and murdered, they travel after leaving the body of young Alter's brother, Ivan. And they slept in an area where bushes hid them. And then they made their way to Rio de Janeiro. And the child would be sexually assaulted several times by this monster during their short travels together. Now, Marcelo, he mentioned to the child that they should live together. And of course, not wanting to anger him, the child readily agreed. Like, okay, yeah, sure, yeah, whatever, dude. Well, the killer, Feeling like he gained the child's trust, he leaves to go to work. And that's when Altair makes a run for it. The man, the killer, the rapist and monster, he had no doubt that when he came back, the boy would still be there. Well, like I said, the kid was no dummy. He was waiting for the perfect time and opportunity to make his escape. And escape he did. He survives a serial killer and helped bring the monster down that not only killed his beloved brother Ivan, but also 13 other innocent young boys in just a few months' span. This man was not going to stop. He needed to be brought down several pegs. Now, once free from his prison, the young boy, Altair, he flees home. He shares with his older siblings what took place. Well, Ivan's body, it's found and identified by his mother, something a parent should never ever have to do. Altair goes on to lead the authorities to where the killer was hunkering down at, and he confesses. No resisting arrest, no wild shootout, no you got the wrong guy, or no you're going to believe a kid over an adult. No, nothing. An immediate confession occurs, and Bob's your uncle, Linda's your aunt, Sally's your sister, Gregory's your brother. Well, you get the idea. While being questioned by police, he sings like a canary. He talks not only about the murder of Ivan, his final murder, his undoing, but he talks about the earlier killings as well, including one where he lured a child with promise of money to an abandoned field and murdered him after growing angry that the child resisted his sexual advances. Now, it's weird because in a lot of cases, a lot of people will admit to murder, but they won't admit to rape. And you know why? Because a lot of prisoners don't handle rape very well, especially when it's child killers and rapists of children, those damn pedophiles. But he was talking all about that stuff. He was talking about his sexual assaults and, oh, how dare this child say no to me. So I quote him when he was being investigated. This is what he had said. I did not notice if he was alive or dead when I ravished him. I could not satisfy myself, and I squeezed his throat once more to make sure his soul went to heaven. Again, he's trying to make it seem like this horrific act is actually a good thing. Like, no, this child, he's going to heaven because of me. I did something good. Disgusting. Now, he was found insane, and he goes to a psychiatric hospital. Horrible stuff. These people, both of these individuals, should have gotten death. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. This week, suicide was discussed. If you or someone you know is going through depression or have suicidal thoughts or tendencies, please know you are not alone. And there are other options that are not so permanent. And please be sure to reach out to the suicide hotline, 1-800-273-8255.
That concludes another fantastic podcast. Legend has it, if you don't tune in, I'll be returning to haunt you. So make sure to tune in for the next episode.
Did you enjoy this week's episode? Listen to the others. They are all phenomenal. Haven't heard every single one yet? No need to cry. Just hit up any of those podcast platforms, such as Spotify, Downcast, Blueberry, Deezer. Basically, wherever you may roam to hear your other spooky podcasts, you'll probably find Paranormal Prowlers podcast lurking in the background. Thanks for stopping by, and
I will see you next week.